Brian Wallach was diagnosed with ALS a little more than a year ago, and since that time, he's been trying to raise $100 million to help find a cure. And a cure for ALS isn't actually a long shot.
You know, when Lou Gehrig was diagnosed, there was absolutely nothing out there. I can sit here today and say that I have hope that within my lifetime, I can see a cure or a curative cocktail for this disease. That's something that we couldn't have said 20 years ago.
Plus, in the 1940s, the Montfort Point Marines were trained in North Carolina. They fought in World War II and were the first African-American Marine company. But today, some of those veterans live in Chicago. For decades, they've relied on a local veterans center that's now at risk of closing. We'll learn more about this story with WBEZ's Susie Ahn. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. We'll get started after the latest news. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up later this hour, the founder of a new organization, IMALS, joins us to share his story of how he's hoping to fundraise for a cure for the disease. Also, we've been keeping an eye on movement today in Springfield regarding raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour. That increase would happen gradually over the next 6 years. Illinois State Senate Democrats have been negotiating with Governor Pritzker. If you recall, this is a big campaign promise he made about raising the minimum wage. He's also been working with leaders from labor and business groups. Democrats want to move on this quickly. The bill passed out of committee yesterday. It could come up for a Senate floor vote today. State Senator Kimberly Lightford says she wants this bill to become law before Governor Pritzker's first budget address. That's on February 20th. So stay tuned to the station today for more updates on that. But first, the Montfort Point Marines were the first African Americans to serve in the U.S. Marine Corps. This was back during World War II. This was also during a time when the entire military was segregated. In 2011, all Montfort veterans, both living and deceased, were awarded the Congressional Gold Medal. And today, several of those Marines are still alive, and they're actually living here in Illinois. Most of them are in their 90s, but they're now at risk of losing a veterans center for them on Chicago's South Side. WBEZ Chicago reporter Susie Ahn has been reporting on this. She's in studio with me now from the University of Illinois Illini Center in downtown Chicago. Hi, Susie. Welcome back to the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
So you've spoken with a number of these members of these Montfort Point Marines Association. First, can you tell us just about these gentlemen? Originally, when we were thinking, how many black men enrolled in the Marines during World War II?
So it was about 20,000. And this was, you know, as you mentioned, back in 1942, they were allowed to enlist after a presidential order allowed them to join. And this was during World War II when, after a while, they needed more men out there. So this is why they joined. And they were all taken to a training camp in North Carolina called Montfort Point. And so this is where they were all going.
So if you were African American and you enlisted in the Marines, they sent you to Montfort Point.
Right. No other training camp. This is the one that you went to if you were an African American man. And so, you know, these men, about 20,000 of them between 42 and 49, this is where they would go. And now, you know, we have a number of them in the Chicago area still living who are now in their 90s.
And I know you had a chance to speak with some of them, and we're going to hear from some of them in a minute. I wonder if you can just describe, you were able to talk to quite a few of them. How did they describe their experience? Were they welcomed into the military?
Well, some of them, you know, they were saying that they enthusiastically enlisted. But when they got there, one gentleman, Stanley Porter, who is now 97, he described it as, you know, they were pretty much seen as, quote, things. You know, they were told that they could do shoe shining or food service, but they weren't allowed to fight at first. We have a clip from Stanley Porter, and he describes a visit from a general who is supposed to, you know, kind of be a voice of encouragement.
Giving a pep talk to the troops, right?
Yeah, but he told them something else, and so we've got that story from Mr. Porter.
When he came into camp, he wanted to insult us. And the things that he said did insult us. He said, "It's been some time since I was stateside. There has been many changes. First, I noticed that they have added the women, and then the dogs. He said, but when I came into this camp, I saw you people wearing our globe and anchor. I knew there was a war on. What could be more insulting?
That's 97-year-old Stanley Porter, a Marine veteran, sharing with Susie on his experience being one of the first African-Americans in the country to enroll in the Marines. So, Susie, it sounds like it was a tough experience in many ways for these gentlemen.
That's right. I mean, sort of at every turn, they faced obstacles. Their white counterparts did not want them there, but Mr. Porter talked about how they just didn't want that to discourage them. They kind of lived by this motto. You know, I would just say at 97,
does he remember everything?
He has such a sharp memory. I was pleasantly surprised by it. Just a very sharp memory. He even recited a poem that they kind of, you know, the men kind of held with them as sort of their in a way, a battle cry for them, you know, within their own camp to not be discouraged by this.
And you also met with 93-year-old Edwin Fazer as well, and he also lives in Chicago.
Mm-hmm. And that's Edwin Fazer. He does live in Chicago, and again, when I met Mr. Fazer, he was just a very charming man. It was 10 in the morning on a very cold Chicago day. To keep warm, he decided he's going to have some brandy at 10 in the morning, and that's fine.
When I am 93, I would also aspire to do that.
And so, you know, like Mr. Porter, he described his time first arriving in the Marine training camp there. And he described that they weren't welcome and what he experienced. And we have some tape from him as well.
The fellows who were currently in the Marine Corps thought that it was theirs and theirs exclusively. And they said that you're here and we don't want you here. And so therefore we're going to make it so difficult you're going to wish you'd never signed up. Well, the more they increased their toughness, the more we decided that it wasn't going to turn us around.
That's 93-year-old Edwin Fazer, another Marine veteran of World War II, one of the first African-Americans to serve in the Marine Corps, the Montfort Point Marines. Susie Ahn for WBEZ has been speaking with these gentlemen and is with us here in talking about this. Susie, so how did these guys end up? Were they from Chicago, some of them, or how did they end up here?
A number of them were from the Chicago area. Mr. Fazer, I believe he grew up in down south, and actually he enlisted at 16 years old. He had to get permission from his mother to enlist. So after the war was over, I believe during the Great Migration around that time, he made his way up to Chicago, as did several other men.
And so their story wasn't that well known. I mentioned in 2011, I believe there was a proclamation, 2012, a ceremony when President Obama awarded several hundred of these veterans with congressional gold medals. Were these gentlemen able to attend the ceremony?
Yes, they were. And, you know, I talked to Mr. Porter and Fazer and another gentleman who is with the Chicago group. You know, at the time, this is nearly 70 years later that they're finally getting that recognition. One of the gentlemen, you know, talked about how he cried tears of joy all the way to the ceremony for finally getting recognized. And he also talked about how, you know, he almost didn't make it because his wife was very ill at the time, but she convinced him to go, and, you know, he got the medal and was able to show it to her before she passed. But they, you know, it was a bittersweet moment because several of their fellow Marines died before that point because, as I mentioned, it was decades later that they got this recognition.
And so I imagine for these veterans, like a lot of veterans, associations and veteran centers are great places for them to meet and spend time with fellow veterans. So there is actually an association on the south side of Chicago that was opened in the 1970s, the Montfort Point Marines veteran, there's a Chicago chapter. Mm-hmm. What kind of role did that veteran center play in the community on the south side of Chicago?
So it's something like a VFW hall. So one, you know, it's sort of a place for camaraderie, not just for Marines, but they accept other people of service.
Different from all the branches of the military.
And so, you know, it serves as sort of, you know, that type of social club, but they also do work in the community, like back to school events, giving out school supplies. At one point, they had a food pantry. They would also give scholarships, Christmas baskets over the holidays. And they also had a banquet hall, which, you know, they would say they would price that at a point for the community that was affordable for the community. But in the past several years, that's gone into disrepair.
We had a conversation on Veterans Day about VFWs and Foreign Legion halls and how hard it is from a business standpoint for them to stay open. Mm-hmm. Is that the same thing that's happening here with the center on the south side? Is there in danger of closing?
Yeah. So for them, they are like other places around the country. They are seeing a decline in membership. So, you know, at one point they were getting several hundred members who were paying into that. That's dropped off in the past several years. Plus, they also had that income coming in from the banquet hall, but because of severe roof damage, they're not getting that income anymore. So they've fallen behind on property taxes, and now that's put them in danger of closing.
And so because of the property tax situation, I wonder what role Cook County, has the county played in this?
Yeah, so because they were several years behind on paying those taxes, Cook County put the property tax up for a tax sale. So essentially, a real estate company bought the tax, and they own that debt now. And over time, that they have to pay interest on that. So at this point, if they don't pay the $70,000+ they owe on the back tax and the interest, they could just lose the property altogether.
And so with the idea of these veterans losing the center, I know you spoke with Sharon Stokes Perry, who's the president of the Chicago chapter of the Montfort Point Veterans. She credits their legacy with influencing her decision to join the military. How is she handling all of this now?
Right. I mean, she is doing everything she can to keep the center open. She herself is a veteran, and she joined back in the 80s, and she wants to make sure that this legacy continues. And she talks a little bit about why she feels it's so important to her and why it should be important to others.
You know, I'm proud of this organization. I'm proud to be the president of this organization. I'm proud of the legacy of the first African Marines, because they kind of broke the color barrier. It's like baseball. They broke the color barrier.
That's Sharon Stokes Perry, president of the Chicago chapter of the Montfort Point Marines. So, Susie, what's next then? It sounds like they're in a not a great financial situation.
Yeah. So they tried several things. They tried to get a tax-exempt status as a charitable organization. That did not go through. But the real estate company that bought their debt has extended their deadline to pay the tax. That's now at the end of May. But we have some good news in that, you know, there's a bit of a corruption scandal going on now in Chicago City Hall, which that's not great. But that's somehow worked out well for the Montfort Point Marines, where people are trying to ditch campaign donations that came from
From Alderman Ed Burke.
From Alderman Ed Burke and Alderman Danny Solis. People are trying to, you know, mayoral candidates are trying to ditch
right,
those
because
funds.
Everyone's trying to give back money that Ed Burke gave to them now that he has possibly been charged in this corruption scheme. It was the FBI, I believe, investigating him.
That's
so
right.
So, Susie, are you saying they're giving those campaign donations? Are they giving it to the veterans?
They are. So mayoral candidate and state comptroller Susana Mendoza, she received some $140,000 donation from Alderman Danny Solis. Now she needs to get rid of that. So she gave that to the Montfort Point Marines, which brings them very close to getting to their $200,000 goal of both paying the back taxes and getting on those much-needed repairs to their building.
And so Sharon has also set up a GoFundMe page, and so it sounds like, are they pretty close on that page
they
also?
They are, yes. So you combine that money from Mendoza, and they've got about $30,000 on the GoFundMe. So they are, they're almost there. They just another few thousand dollars to go to reach their goal.
I feel like you've just added an only in Chicago element to the story, right, Susie? But I do think, I wonder how, I'm sure that these gentlemen are really pleased that people are hearing their story now as well. Like just the fact that you're able to talk to, this is a whole generation that unfortunately won't be with us forever. So it's great that we're able to hear their stories now.
Such history there, and just to be remembered by that.
So Susie Ahn has been reporting on this for WBEZ. We'll tweet out Susie's stories. We have photos as well that Susie, that WBEZ has taken of the Marines. If you're interested in learning more about that, we'll have those links. We'll share them via Twitter. We'll also have them at our website at 21stshow.org. Susie, thanks for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Stay tuned. Coming up next on the 21st, an Ipsos poll found that 60% of Americans know nothing about ALS. Coming up, we're going to be speaking with Chicagoan Brian Wallach. He tells us more about raising awareness through his organization, I Am ALS. He was diagnosed nearly a year ago, and now he's working to raise $100 million towards finding a cure for the disease. By the way, speaking of coming up, next week we're going to be broadcasting from NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. We're going to be speaking with lawmakers, with Illinois students, even longtime journalists. Morning Edition host Scott Simon, who's a native Chicago and is going to be joining us to talk about the Cubs and more. But we also are going to be sitting down with our congressional delegation, including Senators Durbin and Duckworth, and we would love to hear what questions you have for them. You can go to askthe21st.org. That's askthe21st.org to submit questions you'd like our senators to answer. We'll try to go through those, and when we sit down with them next week, we'd love to hear from you, your questions you have for them. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. What do you think of when you hear ALS? Maybe Lou Gehrig or the Ice Bucket Challenge come to mind? Even though there's estimated that about 20,000 Americans are living with ALS, beyond that, many of us don't know much about the disease. Brian Wallach was first diagnosed with ALS in November of 2017 at age 37. He was given 6 months to live. Today, him and his wife are fighting for a cure through his organization, I Am ALS, which he's just launched. Brian's here with me at the Illini Center in downtown Chicago. Brian, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
So before we get into what you're doing, probably I think the first question a lot of people always probably ask you is, how are you doing?
And it's a great question. As you'll find when you meet more people with ALS, there is a broad spectrum of answers to that. For me, thankfully, I can sit here today and say, I'm on the slower progressing side of the spectrum. So what that means in my day and day out life, my hands are weaker, my voice is a bit different than what you would have heard a few years ago, and I'm no longer able to run the 6.5 minute mile that I could run in college. I was actually a 400 runner in college. You know, running a 20 minute mile now is a pretty good thing, but all things considered, you know, I'm able to do pretty much everything I have been for years. So I'm one of the lucky ones in that respect, because many folks who have ALS actually are at this point in wheelchairs or incapacitated, or a large part have actually passed away, which is part of the difficulty of this disease.
And I wonder if you can tell us a little bit more about what ALS actually is, because I think that's a big education point for a lot of people, myself included. I was doing some research knowing you were coming in, but I think a lot of people in passing, no, okay, that's Lou Gehrig's disease and maybe not much more than that.
Yeah, which was where I was actually before I was diagnosed. You know, if you'd asked me 4 years ago what I knew about ALS, I'd say Lou Gehrig, ice bucket, not good. Now, you know, to actually answer the question, and a lot more. And in short, what ALS does is it basically stops your brain from talking to each part of your body over time. So depending on where your ALS onset starts, you can lose your speech, you can lose functionality in your hands, you can lose the capacity to actually use your legs. And over the course of the disease, you'll actually see functionality decline in every other part of your body. And what happens is ALS patients are kind of left as prisoners in their own body. Their mind typically is often sharp. So you can see all this, you know what's happening, but you can't stop it. And then ultimately, unfortunately, you pass away due to respiratory failure. So obviously it sounds grim because it is, but part of what we are hoping to do through conversations like ours is help educate people about what ALS is, but also about the possibility of finding a cure, which is now a real possibility. And the more amazing thing that I've learned over the last year and a half is that if we cure ALS, it may actually unlock cures to Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, other diseases that obviously affect even more people out there and have the potential to really change the world.
I want to ask you about that in a minute, but I wonder if you would mind sharing for us what it was like when you got your diagnosis and your, not just that initial diagnosis, but then also your education and how you learned about this, because I think your reaction to this is maybe a little bit different than other people in the way that you have created this organization and you flew all over the country talking to doctors and asking them what they needed. I wonder if you can share a little bit of that with us.
I think the best thing to say is immediately you feel very alone because you built a life that you think is sort of the way it will be and should be. And all of a sudden that is ripped away from you. You know, during the course of our conversation here today, a few people, you know, listening may have friends or family that are diagnosed with ALS. And so the most important thing I can say that we took away from our year of travels is you're not alone. There are a lot of people out there that are working on this, that are trying to find a cure. The patient community is an incredible, vibrant community. It's one that will bring you in. It's one that will try to help you in every way possible. But when you get that diagnosis, and for us, we'd actually just come home with our second daughter the day that I was diagnosed initially, you can't help but feel like all is lost. And so what we did, and what I hope many out there will do, is we researched. We found everything that we could, and we then brought that to doctors. And we, you know, got second opinions to make sure that we were getting the best advice possible, because in a fight like this, you have to be your own advocate. Obviously, it's really important to seek out the advice of those who know what they're doing, but you should educate yourself because you're going to find a lot of crazy ideas out there. You're going to find a lot of good ideas out there, and having friends, family, doctors who can help guide you through this is really important because, as one doctor said to me, you're not going to be gone tomorrow. You're going to be here for a while, so get ready for that.
And I wonder, when you're thinking about this, through this, you've learned a lot about ALS. I mean, what do you think do you think there are misconceptions out there that, first of all, people that you want to, any myths you want to dispel?
Yes. I think there are two big ones that I should start with. One is ALS, like cancer, can affect anyone. Any race, any age, any gender, any sex, it doesn't discriminate. I think people often think of ALS as affecting a particular small subset of folks. If that were true, I wouldn't be sitting here having this conversation with you because I'm about 25 years younger than the average ALS onset case. That is one thing that's important because when we realize that ALS can affect everyone, it also helps us understand that curing it does take everyone. The second piece that I would want to make sure to dispel is that ALS is often talked about as a rare disease, and it's true in the sense that there aren't that many people living with ALS, but part of the reason that there aren't that many is because, unfortunately, they pass away so quickly. It amazed me to find out that ALS and multiple sclerosis are diagnosed at the same rate. But when you think about multiple sclerosis, you know far more people because, thankfully, and this is an amazing thing, they're able to live often longer with the actual disease. ALS, that number that you started off with, that 20,000, you know, most folks think that's low. And obviously, if we were able to live for a longer period of time, you would have a much higher number.
My guest is Brian Wallach. He has founded an organization called IMALS. And I want to just touch on something you said, because you mentioned cancer and you said that ALS can affect anyone just like cancer could. But I wonder why you think ALS is less funded, less understood, less known than cancer.
I actually think that the parallel to cancer is one that has really kind of taken hold, at least in my brain and many doctors that I've talked to, in the sense that ALS is kind of like what cancer was back in the 1960s. So we didn't know much about it then. We didn't really have many treatments at that point in time. And so, you know, when you got a cancer diagnosis, that was a really, really difficult thing for a family. And often doctors would tell you, much like they do with ALS now, get your affairs in order. What has changed, and what is an amazing thing when you look at cancer, when you look at the fight against HIV/AIDS, is that there's been decades of research that has moved us inexorably forward towards the point where we can't treat every type of cancer, but we have weapons in the arsenal to actually, you know, fight back against these illnesses that, you know, can take your life so quickly. And I think we are at that tipping point with ALS. I know you mentioned the Ice Bucket Challenge a few minutes ago. For many people, that was probably the first time, outside of, you know, knowing the name Lou Gehrig, that they ever heard the letters ALS. That was a huge moment, because it brought attention, it brought money, and it brought research into the ALS space. And over the last 5 years, there's been an explosion in the identification of ALS genes, in new trials, and the possibility of actually finding a cure. And so my hope is that what we're starting here can help ensure that if we have this conversation in 10 years, we can say, look at all the progress that we're made.
So when we think about that, the goal of IMALS is to fundraise, because you want to fundraise and find a cure for ALS. How much are you hoping to raise?
So we have set a small goal that of raising $100 million over the next 3 years. And I think to break that down a bit, because people talk about fundraising for diseases all the time. What we are really looking at is, my wife and I met on a political campaign back in 2008. And for us, a big part of our experience is understanding community and how community can be so important to helping change your narrative. And so what we want to be able to do is help empower the patients, the caregivers that are living with this fight, to have the mental space, to have the capacity to become leaders in the fight. And in doing so, we hope to be able to introduce them to those of you listening to this show that have never met someone with ALS. And our hope is that when you meet them, you'll want to get involved. And that could mean posting something on social media, that could mean hosting a party, that could mean helping them go to the grocery store one day. And our hope is that eventually you'll see that, you know, this community is really an incredible one, and that you'll be able to give to us to actually help accelerate that fight for a cure. So our goal is really to transform the discussion from a, you know, idea of help us by strictly donating to join us, become a part of this movement, become the change that we need to make a cure real.
So you mentioned you and your wife met on a political campaign, and you actually worked in the Obama administration for a while before you're a lawyer, right? Before coming back to Chicago and being in, and now you're in private practice now?
I am. So I was in the White House for 2 years, went back to private practice, and then was a assistant United States attorney actually in Chicago for 4 years.
I wonder how you think that background has informed you now creating this organization.
It's a great question. I think that the experiences that we carry with us from that time are twofold. One is, it shows you the importance of actually listening, and not just listening, but really seeking out opinions that may differ from yours to understand how you can better actually produce a solution that will help everyone. So the ALS space has a tremendous amount of great groups, great advocates in it already. It's not like we are the first group out there. And so for us, it was really important to be able to go to them, understand what they're doing, and how we can actually help, so that we don't simply do the same thing again and again, but actually augment the incredible work that they're doing now to get more people involved in this fight. And I think the second lesson that I took really from those days was, never underestimate the power of asking a question. Often in fights like this in particular, we will accept the first answer that's given to us because we don't have the capacity to push past it. But if you ask why, if you ask how, if you find yourself actually there getting engaged, it's amazing what you can help accomplish and help drive forward. And that is something that, you know, I want to believe I've known my entire life, but I think crystallized over the course of the last 5 or 6 years for me.
We're talking with Brian Wallach about IMALS. And Brian, I wonder, when you were first diagnosed in 2017, I imagine this question of this organization was not a question you were probably asking immediately.
That's correct. And, you know, immediately, the first thing I thought of was I want to get a bigger iPhone so I can take more videos from my daughter in case I'm not, or daughters in case I'm not here when they're older. But after a few weeks of crying, a few weeks of wondering why, we actually met an amazing doctor who said to my wife, I have good news and I have bad news. Bad news is I can't tell you that your husband doesn't have ALS. Good news is he's going to be around for a while, so get used to him. And the better news is you guys, you know, if you want to, can dive into this space and try to make a difference. You know, he then added, I don't know what that is, but I know that you, you know, the worst thing you can do is not try.
So that's kind of one of the thing. That's one of the many things about ALS is that even the diagnosis itself isn't necessarily immediately clear or apparent. You and I were talking before we went on air. I was sharing with you my breast cancer diagnosis 2 years ago and what I went through, and that you find out right away. Like, it's pretty quick. They're just sort of like, you have cancer, and they tell you right away. That didn't even happen with you.
No, I mean, the diagnosis for ALS is one of exclusion. So you go into a doctor, the doctor says there are, you know, a number of things that you could have. One of them could be ALS. So we're going to go ahead and test you for everything from cancer to Lyme disease to, you know, autoimmune to multiple sclerosis. We're going to try to figure out if any of these other diseases are the cause of your symptoms. And when you get to the end of that road, there is one test that they do that can medically confirm an ALS diagnosis. It's called an EMG, where they basically stick your body with some needles and look at the muscles under the tissue level. And at that point, only after, I think for me, I was actually lucky, it was about 5 or 6 months. For many others, it's much longer. At that point is when they can finally tell you, yes, you have ALS.
So with this research that you are fundraising for, where do you see the most promising lines of research right now?
So the amazing part about my answer to that question is there's a lot. And that is what gives us hope. You know, that and the amazing people that we've met in this journey. There are some promising trials into stem cell work. There's some promising trials into different drug compounds. And, you know, for me, a cure means two things. It means we can either get a, you know, home run that reverses or stops everything, or like HIV, we can build a curative cocktail of drugs. And so in the short term, we know that there are a lot of drugs in the pipeline right now. If those drugs can get through trials into patients and actually help slow down their progression, that's an incredible thing. That's an incredible gift to an ALS patient. And so for us, we want to push as many drugs forward as fast as possible, helping drug companies and helping researchers get the actual capacity to build those drugs, helping patients to get into trials, and helping ultimately to get those drugs through approvals once they're proven effective and to patients as quickly as we can. That's where the funding will go. And that is where we've been short all these years, is it takes a lot of money to take a drug from a concept to reality. And that initial phase where it's in the lab where researchers at universities are doing it, that's often funded through public grants and other sort of philanthropic efforts. That's where we can make a huge difference as IMALS and as a community.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Brian Wallach, a Chicagoan who has just started an organization called IMALS. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. An Ipsos poll that came out last year found that more than 60% of Americans knew little about ALS. 85% did not know that the average lifespan is less than 5 years for those who are diagnosed. That poll was commissioned by Brian Wallach and his organization, I Am ALS, and we're talking about the Chicagoans' work against this disease now. He's with me at the Illini Center in downtown Chicago. Brian, so your goal with this organization is, as you said, is you have a fundraising goal of $100 million over the next 3 years. And I wanted to ask you about, just before the break, we were talking about the idea of a cure and how much of that research hinges on trials and funding. And I wanted to just ask you about what the landscape looks like now. Are there, we were talking earlier about the cancer kind of using cancer as maybe a similar situation. You were using that as an analogy of maybe cancer in the 1960s. Cancer is really well studied and it's really well researched, and there's a lot of money into different types of cancer. I wonder how you think ALS research is by comparison.
It's a growing field, I think is the best way to answer that. So when you look at oncology, that is kind of held up as the gold standard that everyone wants to look at and find a way to emulate or adapt to whatever particular disease area that they're in. For almost every disease space, NIH is a huge source of funding. So when we talk about that $100 million number, that includes both, you know, philanthropic donations that are raised through that grassroots campaign that we want to build over time as a movement through IMALS, but it also includes additional funding from NIH, because NIH will actually give a lot of money every year to different granting requests that deal with every single disease under the sun. Right now, ALS represents a very, very small percentage of that overall budget. And so our goal is to be able to increase that percentage so that we can achieve parity in terms of the research dollars with other terminal illnesses out there. And so for us, a big part of the initial question with IMALS is, how do we get that message out there to folks that if we just get more funding, we can actually find a cure? And that's not just a sort of aspirational tagline.
Isn't kind of like a moonshot thing.
Yeah. I mean, you know, 10 years ago, if I had sat here and said that, you know, someone would have called and said that's a moonshot idea. I can't sit here today and say we're going to have a cure tomorrow, but I can sit here to your question and say that doctors across the country and across the world are looking at different biomarkers, different levels of whatever in my body. And they're looking at different compounds, and they're trying to identify which one of those compounds, which one of those biomarkers is going to actually crack the code to answering ALS. And the steps that have been made in the last 10 years, 5 years, have been incredible vis-a-vis where we were 80 years ago. You know, when Lou Gehrig was diagnosed, there was absolutely nothing out there. I can sit here today and say that I have hope that within my lifetime, I can see a cure or a curative cocktail for this disease. That's something that we couldn't have said 20 years ago. And that's why this campaign becomes so important, because there are many incredible causes out there. For us, what we want people to take away from this discussion, and obviously the work that we're doing, is join us, help cure this thing, help move this disease into that encyclopedia of cured illnesses, and then let's move on together to the next one, and the next one, and the next one.
And so part of the work you're doing with I Am ALS is also making people aware of clinical trials, people with ALS, letting them know about opportunities?
Yes, and part of the difficulty that many ALS patients face is they don't live a mile away from the best ALS center in their neighborhood. You know, many folks may have to travel, you know, tens of hundreds of miles to actually get someplace that actually knows how to treat an ALS patient or is offering a clinical trial.
If you're in Illinois and you're diagnosed with ALS, where do you go for treatment?
You know, there are ALS centers, you know, at the university. So in the center of the state, there's a number up here in Chicago. There's a number down in St. Louis. But, you know, many patients are driving 3, 4, 5 hours to actually get to a clinical trial. And one of the new developments that, you know, gives us hope is doctors have recognized that, and they're trying to find ways to design trials that actually allow you to be in a trial from your home or from your local doctor's office. Obviously, that comes with some complications to it, but that's a big thing, and that enables you as an ALS patient to keep living your life, but also be a part of the advances that we need to find a cure for this thing.
Do you think, or based on the research, Do we think eventually a cure will come from stem cell research?
I think that that's one of the, you know, promising areas. There are a couple of trials going on right now into that question. I think much like HIV, you know, took a cocktail of different drugs, it's probably going to be true for ALS. And what I mean by that is no two ALS patients progress the same way. And so for each patient, you have to be able to go and find out a little bit about them and then be able to treat them. So the good news is the more weapons we have to treat folks, the more we're going to be able to slow down every variety of ALS, and the more we're going to be able to move towards one or two overall omnibus treatments that actually can cure it in one fell swoop. But in the interim, while we're looking for those, finding a different drug every year that could help keep us alive, not a bad thing.
You mentioned at the beginning of our conversation that a cure for this would have ramification for other degenerative diseases, and you mentioned Alzheimer's, Parkinson's. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Sure. I was surprised, actually, when I started talking to doctors and asking the question of, does ALS have any tie to any other disease out there? And the answer I got over and over again was actually, yes, a lot. And part of that is the major issues that are at play in many ALS patients are in this sort of motor neurocortex of the brain. And for many others who are suffering from Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, there are other complications that also start in that area that involve aspects of dementia, aspects of the degradation of the motor neurons. And the commonality there means that if you actually find a cure for one, that curative cocktail can actually help unlock cures for others. The good news and bad news about ALS, bad news for patients, good news for doctors, is that it progresses at the fastest rate of all those different diseases. What that means is that if you want to set up a clinical trial, it can show you in the shortest amount of time whether or not a drug is effective. And so that's why, you know, I say if you cure ALS, you can actually unlock these other disease answers, because, you know, we'll be able to find out quickly if a drug works. And if it works for ALS, we can repurpose it and try it in other diseases soon after.
You mentioned at the beginning of this also that you want this to be, in some ways, a grassroots movement, your organization, IAM-ALS. How do you want people who are listening to get involved?
Join us. Go to our website, www.iamals.org. Follow us on Twitter at iamals.org. Follow us on Facebook. You don't have to go online and become a large donor. You don't even have to go online and start posting about this every day. But our hope and our belief is that if you sign up, if you follow us, you'll find some way to join us. You'll find something that moves you. And once you take that first step, we want to bring you into the fold, not just for one time, but to become a part of this family, become a part of this movement, and help us find a cure for this thing finally.
You said that one of the things that you don't want people to feel is what people often feel when they get a diagnosis, which is that they're not alone. And I wonder, as you've started this organization and as you've connected with people with ALS, probably not just around the country but the world, I wonder what stories stick out to you.
There are the heart-wrenching stories of a 9-year-old girl who I met who was diagnosed with ALS. Those ones, you know, can't help but haunt you. But there are also the stories that actually make you smile of individuals who do incredible things in response to their diagnosis. I'm thinking of one person in particular who made a viral Ice Bucket Challenge video. He happens to be from a family that has genetic ALS. And he took a video of himself in underwear that had a couple of choice words on it while he was washing his car with that underwear. It's one of those moments where you realize that when you get diagnosed with a disease like breast cancer or ALS, you don't stop being the person that you were the day before your diagnosis. And I'm reminded of that on a daily basis. And that's one of the most inspiring things about the patients and caregivers that we meet. They're incredible souls who've led incredible lives and will continue to do so. And part of our mission with IAM-ALS is to remind everyone of that fact. They are your sisters, your brothers, your friends, your neighbors. That's why we want you involved in this fight.
Thank you for sharing all of that. And I think a lot of people will find inspiration from that. But I also wonder about when you're diagnosed with a disease, it's a really tough thing for a lot of people to deal with, and people don't know how to handle it. I feel like we're not really great in American culture about handling sort of suffering or bad things, because we always want everything to be okay. So I wonder how having ALS has changed your perspective on interactions with people on a day-to-day basis.
We deal with illness in the shadows. You know, you get diagnosed in a room with a doctor. You live most of your life in a small windowless room with nurses doing testing. For me, one of the biggest takeaways is that we all carry burdens, and that's important for us to remember. Some burdens are obvious, some are not. And so it has made me appreciate in a way that I hoped I did before, but definitely more cognizant of now, how every interaction with a person leaves the chance for them to leave feeling a little bit better about themselves. So when you meet a person with ALS, if they're in a wheelchair, if they're otherwise sort of disabled, don't avert your eyes, don't look away. They're the same as they were before. They act slightly differently, they operate slightly differently, but they are living a life just with some different challenges. And so, you know, the people that I've met who've come up to me, given me a big hug and said, good luck, love you, are amazing. They make you smile all day long.
That's Brian Wallach, who has started the organization I Am ALS. He's based in Chicago, as he's been telling us. You can go online to find out more. Brian, thanks for taking the time to speak with us. I appreciate it.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
That's all the time we have for today and for this week. Coming up on Monday, we'll be talking about the era of Prohibition and how it relates to Southern Illinois. It was a time of intense cultural and political conflict, not just speakeasies and jazz. Actually, when some Prohibition advocates teamed up with the Ku Klux Klan to target Italian and French immigrants. Here's Harvard history professor Lisa McGurr.
There was an effort by both Protestant ministers and the leaders of the community, particularly a man named Sam Stearns, who was the chair of the Williamson County Board of Supervisors and was also the Klan Klegel, that is the leader of the local Ku Klux Klan. Sam Stearns essentially launched a campaign to rein in liquor law violations, but that campaign effectively targeted, again, the drinking of others and brought in white Protestant miners who were really just concerned about their economic grievances and the problem of, you know, the eroding conditions in the mines into a new campaign to target the drinking of Italian immigrants who also happened to be competing with them for jobs in the mines. And essentially the law and order crusade that was launched redirected some of those anxieties toward another target, which was the men and women who had come across the sea. And that's precisely how they identified the threat. In some law and order public meetings, they actually argue that those who are responsible for eroding your way of life are those immigrant men and women from across the sea, and they promised that they would essentially force them out. So there was a Catholic church that had been established, a flourishing church, because of the Italian community in Williamson County, and they said, you know, all those bootleggers, namely Catholics, will be in jail before the foundation of the new church is built.
We'll learn more about that history and how it was expressed in the form of anti-immigrant violence on Monday. Plus, next week, we're going to be broadcasting from NPR headquarters in Washington. We're going to be speaking with lawmakers, Illinois students, longtime journalist Scott Simon, and we'd love to hear some of your questions. We are sitting down with some members of our congressional delegation, including our senators, Dick Durbin and Tammy Duckworth. What questions do you have for them? We're collecting questions at askthe21st.org. That's askthe21st.org. If you have the NPR One app, you can download that from wherever you get your smartphone apps. It's an easy way to find past shows. You just download it, set your home station so you can get your local home station news. And if you search for the 21st to follow us, it's a good way to listen to past programs or wherever you get your podcasts. You can follow us on Twitter. Our handle is 21STShow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. When we're not on air, you can also follow us for the latest in Illinois news. And next week, we'll be tweeting lots of pictures of D.C. If you want to message us on Facebook, we're there too. All those links, every other way to contact us. If you want to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, find links to Access the 21st, just remember our website, which is 21stshow.org. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio, who's our senior producer. Bobby McSwine is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, and we're broadcasting today from the Illini Center, the University of Illinois Illini Center in downtown Chicago. Thanks for listening.